Brady filling in for Marty Moscowane. We've all seen the big, huge container ships out on the ocean or chugging up a big American river, but have you really spent much time thinking about the global industry connected to that one ship? We're going to do that this hour. One of our guests is Rose George. She spent 5 weeks aboard a container ship and then wrote her book. It's titled 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry that puts clothes on your back, gas in your car, and food on your plate. Rose George joins us from BBC in Leeds. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
And John Fastman is planning a similar trip aboard a container ship soon, I'm told, and we're going to learn more about that. He brings a wealth of knowledge about the business side of the shipping industry. He's the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for The Economist. John Fastman joins us from Singapore. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks, Jeff.
So, Rose, I want to start with you and some numbers. You had some fascinating numbers near the beginning of your book. But we'll even start with the title, which is 90% of Everything. You asked people how much of what we buy is transported by sea, and people routinely underestimate that amount, right?
Yeah, there was a really interesting video done by the Maritime Foundation in the UK. And, you know, I grew up in a maritime nation, supposedly. And they asked people on the streets of Southampton, which is a major port city, how much of stuff comes by sea. And it was 30%, 40%, don't know. And nobody came anywhere near the real figure, which is, of course, 90%. It's actually 95% in the UK, but it's generally worldwide. 90% of global trade travels by ship at some point.
Yes, some of the statistics are extraordinary, that trade carried by sea increased fourfold since 1970. You say that there are more than 100,000 ships at sea and 6,000 container vessels, and that the biggest container ship can hold 746 million bananas.
I think that's probably out of date by now. I think Maersk, the company whose ship I sailed on, now have these enormous ships called Triple E's, and I think they can probably carry even more bananas by now.
Wow. So, John Fastman, let's turn to you, and let's just kind of talk a bit about how the shipping business is doing these days.
Well, it is doing better than it was 2 or 3 years ago, and that's largely because global trade is doing better than it was 2 or 3 years ago. It's very dependent on trade. The problem it has now is one of overcapacity, and that's largely because ships are very big and complicated to build, and so they take a long time to build. And so these companies placed orders in the pre-2008 boom years, and they got a ton of ships in 2008 and 2011 when there wasn't much going on, and so now there's much more supply than demand. So there's a lot of capacity, but the shipping company's revenue is not doing too great.
And this kind of boom and bust cycle, we see that in the energy industry here in the U.S. Is that boom and bust, they have those cycles? From what I'm reading, just preparing for this program, it sounds like they have those boom and bust cycles on steroids.
Yes, exactly. It is trade dependent, too. So the boom and bust cycle track, not exactly, but usually a year or two behind what the sort of global economy is doing.
The economics of this business are really interesting to me. And Rose, I want to turn back to you. Something that you point out in your book that I thought was pretty fascinating, that shipping is so cheap now that it kind of creates some odd economics. And you write about one involving Scottish cod. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so it's actually, as John was saying, because of the nature of supply and demand, it can get very, very cheap to ship stuff for the consumer or for the person who's shipping. And so, but also because of the nature of the global economy and globalization and containerization, how cheap it's made things to ship things, it's now actually cheaper for the Scottish cod industry to ship their cod all the way to China, where it gets filleted. I think you say filleted, but anyway.
I like filleted.
And then it gets frozen and sent all the way back to Scotland, where it's then sold. And that's quite common. I mean, I think Monterey shrimp does the same thing. I think quite a few foodstuffs do the same thing. And that's just because containerization has made everything so efficient and so cheap for the consumer.
And John, why is shipping cheap. I mean, why? How is it possible that you can catch fish in one place, send it halfway across the world to have it filleted or filleted, and then ship it back to that same place where it came from? How is that possible?
Well, because you're shipping it with a ton of other stuff, and so the marginal cost of adding a few fish to a giant container ship isn't that great, and labor in China is so much less than labor costs in Scotland.
Well, and I guess it also sort of speaks to how well-developed this industry is, because, I mean, we already talked about 100,000 ships, you know, motoring all over the globe at any one time. This is a mature industry that's kind of got its systems down, it sounds like.
Yes, that's certainly the case. There are set routes at set times. It's very predictable which businesses like. Prices are nice and low.
And Rose, I want to get a little bit back to your book, and you spent 5 weeks on a container ship. To just kind of lay out the background there. Where did you start? Where did you go? And what ship were you on?
I ran away to sea on Maersk Kendall, which was a mid-sized container ship. This was back in 2010. And I departed from Felixstowe, which is a port on the eastern coast of England. Very big container port, and I disembarked pretty much 5 weeks later in Singapore. And on that journey, travelled a little bit around Europe, down through the Suez Canal, through pirate waters, through the Indian Ocean, stopping off along the way, and ended up in Singapore. And I did not want to get off.
You didn't want to get off even after 5 weeks?
No, I was very grumpy.
Why?
Because I really loved being on the ship. I mean, I have to differentiate between what working on a ship is like and my experience on a ship. I was working, obviously, as a reporter and journalist, but I was having a career on a ship. Being a seafarer in this day and age can be difficult. But for me, for my experience, I just loved it. I think it was, there's nowhere else like it on Earth, because you are, even though we are surrounded by everything that consumer society needs, all that stuff, you're actually more removed from it than anywhere else. And you're in the middle of the wildest place on the planet, which is the ocean. And it's just an extraordinary experience. And at the same time, you're living in quite an intimate environment with a very small crew. I mean, these massive ships have crews of usually no more than 20. And I was allowed, I got on very well with the captain. He was a great captain, and he would let me go and sit on the bridge, read the charts, listen to the radios. I mean, it was just an extraordinary experience.
And did you see many other women out there?
Well, I didn't expect to, because I knew that only 2% of seafarers globally are women, and most of those work in the passenger industry and the cruise industry. But actually, when I got on board and I wandered around the ship on the first day, and there was hardly anybody around, but one person who was around was Pinky, the cook, who was a Filipina. So, yes, there were two women on board that ship, which makes it quite unusual.
And lots of folks who work on ships are from the Philippines?
Yes, so the Philippines supplies a quarter of the world's seafarers. It's a very, very big maritime nation. And I'm sure John has a very good economic reason for that, but what the Filipinos told me is that we are cheap and speak good English. And they have about 800 maritime schools in the Philippines now, some better than others. But it's just seen as a good career. I mean, Filipinos, obviously, there's a huge diaspora of working Filipinos overseas, from, you know, domestic servants in Hong Kong to seafarers. And so on my ship, while the officer's saloon, when we sat down to dinner, was a smorgasbord of the world's nationalities. There was Indians, Moldavians, Chinese, Burmese. The other dining hall, which was the crew, the ratings mess room, was entirely Filipino. And that's pretty standard.
And so, John, why is that? Why do we see a lot of people from the Philippines working on these ships?
I think Rose got it exactly right. They're cheap and they speak very good English. It's the same reason we see a lot of Filipinos in the Philippines working in call centers. It's also, you have to think about what it looks like. There's just a tremendous seafaring tradition in the Philippines, particularly from the main islands, but from Mindanao and Visayas.
And back to you, Rose. you already kind of alluded to how big these ships are, but maybe you could help us understand it. We're talking like multiple football fields. I don't know if football fields translate for you, but they're really big. How do you sort of describe to people how big these ships are, these container ships?
Well, I can use the football field analogy, but then we get a bit confused between American football and soccer. So I think it's my ship, I think, was about 3 to 4 soccer fields long. So it was around 300 meters. I think that's about right. Mm-hmm. Every morning I would get up and I would walk around the ship when we weren't in pirate waters, when I wasn't allowed on deck. And it would take me a good 20 minutes, half an hour to circumnavigate the deck. So these are big, big ships. I thought that it was enormous, the ship that I was on, but actually these days it's considered pretty small. It carried, at the time, nearly 7,000 TEU, so 20-foot equivalent, which is what they call the smaller containers. But that's not a big ship.
You've mentioned pirates a couple of times now, and we're going to spend some time talking about pirates. We even had a question on Twitter from someone who asked if we were going to talk about pirates, and I see that John Fastman tweeted back that he ardently hopes so. So I appreciate the humor. John, you're going to be making a trip like the one that Rose made soon?
I am, but unfortunately much, much shorter. It's just a few days. This is I'm going to be going on a triple E from the port of Yantian, which is where a lot of the manufactured goods from Shenzhen come out, just down to Tanjung Pelapas, north of Singapore.
And we have just about a minute left before a break, but just kind of describe what you hope to learn on that trip.
Well, I have followed two very simple rules in my journalistic career, and one is use any excuse to do a story in England, and the other is use any excuse to do a story at sea. So really, I hope to sort of enjoy being on the ocean, first of all. And second, I just like to see what contemporary life is like at sea. I'd like to sort of learn a lot of what Rose did and just sort of be on the water and know what it feels like to be in one of these, in a very remote place.
That is John Fastman. He is the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for The Economist. He's on a scratchy telephone line from Singapore. We really appreciate your taking the time to join us here, and he's going to be back in the next segment, too. We're also talking with Rose George, and she's the author of the book 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry That Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. If you have a question or comment about the global shipping industry, these are the two people to ask. You can join our discussion by calling 1-888-477-9499. You can also send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're looking forward to having a conversation about pirates. That's going to be coming up here pretty soon. We'll be right back after a break.
PNC Arts Alive and Philadelphia Photo Arts Center support WHYY and announce Philly Photo Day October 10th, when everyone can take a photograph and collectively create an exhibit that depicts a day in our city. More at philaphotoarts.org.
The Agnes Irwin School supports WHYY and is hosting an open house for pre-K through grade 4 on Wednesday, October 8th from 9 to 11 a.m. on its campus located at Ithan Avenue and Conestoga Road in Rosemont. With all girls education through grade 12, parents are invited to meet the lower school faculty, tour classes, and learn more about the Agnes Irwin experience firsthand. More information at 610-525-8400 or agnesirwin.org. Agnes Irwin, open the door.
The Penn Museum supports WHYY. Friday, October 31st through Sunday, November 2nd, the Penn Museum hosts the Treasures Jewelry Sale and Show, presented by the Women's Committee of the Penn Museum. Treasures features antique, vintage, and contemporary jewelry and accessories from 24 designers and dealers drawn from around the country. Proceeds benefit the Penn Museum's cultural and educational programs, open to the public with general admission. Details at wcpennmuseum.com.
I'm Jerry McGinnis, managing partner for KPMG Philadelphia. Our audit, tax, and advisory professionals are passionate about turning knowledge into value to benefit our clients and the capital markets we serve. More at kpmg.com. KPMG supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady. We're talking about ships and how important they are to our economy with Rose George. She wrote the book 90% of Everything, referring to how much of the stuff around you comes by ship. It's even higher than 90% now. And John Fastman, Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for The Economist. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. And I can't tell you both how much I've been looking forward to talking about pirates. This is going to be fun. So, John, let's start with you. And are pirates a big issue for this industry?
They are a good size issue for this industry. There are two things I found that are happening that are very interesting. The first is there is this what's called the JSI, the Joint Shipping Initiative, and that's a fund set up by large shipping companies, Maersk and Mediterranean, and several of the biggies. And it is basically a development fund for eastern Somalia. So it tries to give young Somali men vocational training and things to do other than turn to piracy. Other thing I found that was interesting is when a few months ago, there was a report of a huge spike in piracy incidents in the Malacca Strait, and that's the choke point that runs between Singapore and Malaysia and Indonesia. And it had been quite plagued with pirates about 10 years ago, but that had stopped. And so it was very interesting to learn why there is this enormous spike now. And when I started looking into it, what I found was it wasn't that there were more of what we would think of as pirate attacks. It's that for sort of police and insurance purposes, almost anything that involved theft on board a ship became classified as piracy. So that includes, and most of these incidents were, sort of someone sneaking on board and stealing a rope or a penknife while they were. And so one thing you should bear in mind as you see reports of spikes in piracy that are pure numbers is to bear in mind what those attacks might actually entail and how reporting requirements alter what you think of as piracy.
And Rose, I guess when we think of pirates these days, I think most of us sort of automatically think of Somali pirates. I think all those two things go together almost without thinking much these days. But pirates are from a number of different places, is that right?
Yeah, they are. And I mean, the Malacca Straits has historically had huge problems with piracy, and it was, I know John knows more about this than me, but it was eradicated by various literal nations coming together, so the surrounding nations. But actually, I don't think that people did put Somali pirates together until a couple of years ago, when Captain Phillips came out. I don't think anybody noticed piracy at all. I don't think it can't have been in the attention of the general public, because otherwise, how could it have continued for as long as it did? And I really do get quite, I suppose upset is too strong a word, but I do. It does bother me that when people talk pirates, they think it's not a big deal. Because if you look at what happened during the heights of Somali piracy, and I sailed through the Indian Ocean when it was at its height, 2010, 2011. Luckily, it's been largely eradicated at the moment. But the brutality that was meted out to the hostages, and when I sailed through down into the high-risk area, as it was known, there were about 544 seafarers being held hostage. And I just, you know, it baffles me as to how that could have been allowed to happen and how it was allowed to continue. There were some ships that were held for 3 years. There were seafarers getting their arms chopped off. There were seafarers being keel-hauled under the ship. That's, you know, made to dragged under the ship on a rope. And none of this was really coming out in the press or getting any attention. And luckily, the shipping industry did come together eventually, and the military patrols did start to work, and ships started to carry armed guards. Lots of flag states started to say that was acceptable, and that has pretty much eradicated Somali piracy. But it's not permanent, and if any of those things are let up, if they're also diminished, then unless Somalia is rebuilt fantastically, then Somali piracy will come back.
Well, and you know, you raise a really good point here, because I've sort of joked about pirates, and we have something called Talk Like a Pirate Day, and it does become sort of a joke. But you're talking about something very, very serious here, and I think to underscore that, you spent on a night on something called Pirate Watch. Tell me about that.
Well, I spent a week on Pirate Watch because it took us a week to get through the danger. Well, at the point I went through it, pretty much the entire Indian Ocean was considered a risk area for piracy. Now, our ship was not considered a risk because it had a freeboard, which was 10 meters high. So that's the side of the ship between the ocean and the deck. And that was considered too high for pirates to get their ladders up. But the day before we went through the Bab el Mandeb Strait, a ship was hijacked successfully, and 13 Chinese crew were held for nearly a year, I think. And we did have suspicious attacks. There were small boats who came up to our ship, had a look, and then luckily turned tail and fled. But there was a lot of tension on the ship. I mean, seafarers are a tough lot, and they're not going to admit to anything. And one of them, one of the Filipinos, who was called Archimedes, hilariously, Archie for short, he said he didn't even believe in pirates, even though a friend of his had been taken hostage for 9 months. So there was kind of bluster, there was genuine tension on the ship, and they were going through that every couple of months. And so it was a really big deal. So I'm afraid Talk Like a Pirate Day does kind of fall flat with me, and I do tend to tweet phrases in Somali like get down on deck and put your hands behind your head, and you know, which is how pirates generally have talked over the last 10 years.
And John, has there been much success in prosecuting pirates?
Relatively little. They're hard to prosecute, as far as I know. It's not something I've really looked into.
Okay. Is that something that you've looked into, Rose?
Yes, it is, actually. I mean, when I came aboard ashore in Mombasa, because I actually went back to sea on a counter-piracy warship for 10 days, and we went from Mombasa to Mogadishu and then came back. And afterwards, I was getting a bit frustrated because I'd never seen a pirate. Not that I actually really wanted to, but, you know, that's how journalists think. And so I went to watch a trial in a courthouse in Mombasa where alleged pirates were on trial, and I just went and glared at them, essentially. But then I did start looking into prosecutions, and the trouble is that for a very long time, no nations would prosecute. So it was left to Kenya and eventually the Seychelles to do all the piracy prosecutions. And it was, as John said, it's very difficult because most of your witnesses have long since gone off to sea on other ships. They're very difficult to track down. You can't generally get anyone in the act of piracy. But the thing that changed things was the Maersk Alabama. And after that, particularly the US did begin to prosecute pirates, and has in fact convicted, I think it's just under 30 or so pirates have been convicted in the US. But I'm not sure that that has a great effect if you're a very poor Somali young man and piracy is your best option.
We're talking with Rose George and John Fassman. If you want to join the conversation, our discussion about the global shipping industry, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499, the email address radiotimes@whyy.org, and the Twitter address is @WHYY Radio Times. We received an email from Liz, and she has a question for both of you. She asks, how often do shipping containers drop their cargo? And she asks this because she's heard of a shipping container that went through a storm and dropped millions of Legos and plastic toy pieces that are still found today along UK coast. Have you heard of this, Rose?
Yeah, there's actually a very good book called Flotsometrics, and there's another book called Moby Duck. And both of them talk about a very famous case where A ship in a very, very heavy weather did lose a lot of its cargo in containers, and it was actually plastic ducks, I think. I don't think they were rubber ducks, but lots of ducks and other toys ended up floating around the world, and an oceanographer called Curtis Ebsmeyer was able to track the movements of the ocean using these flotsam. So it's really, both of those books are really fascinating. But the answer to how many containers go aboard every year, Well, you get different numbers from different people. The official number, I think, from the World Shipping Council is a few hundred. There's often a figure that's used that's 10,000. I'm not sure how either of them come up with those numbers. But if you talk to any yachters or leisure sailors, they'll often have stories of coming across shipping containers floating at sea.
And John, these shipping containers, I think most of us who, you know, live our life on land will see them like on trains or on the backs of trucks, and they'll say words like Maersk, or what are some of the other names that they say on them?
ILN, ILM is big. There's an oily company that makes a lot of them this big. Yeah, but mostly Maersk and ILN, ILM.
Huh. And these containers, they haven't existed forever. Rose says in her book that they kind of were developed in the 1970s. Can you explain why containing the product in these big metal boxes was such a big deal?
Well, it's the buzzword is multimodal, which means you can load them on the back of a truck, you can use a crane to lift them onto a ship, and then have them put onto a train, all without removing the goods, all with really a minimum of contact. So that's really what drove the shipping boom, is that it became standard, efficient, very easy.
Unfortunately, the line is cutting out there. But Rose, maybe you could kind of pick up. Are you back there, John? Yeah, unfortunately, John's telephone line is not behaving very well right now, but we'll try to get him back when the signal gets a little bit better. But Rose, let's pick that idea up with you, that containers became much more important in the 1970s, and this idea of them being this multimodal, being able to take it off a ship, put it on a train, or put it on a truck. Why is that important?
Well, there's always been sort of containerization, really. I mean, back to the ancient Romans and the Greeks, they used to transport their oil in containers. So the idea of putting things in discrete containers was not new. But what was brilliant was a U.S. ship owner, actually a truck company owner called Malcolm McLean, who in sort of late 50s, 60s, realized that if he could persuade... And it was quite a big ask. If you could persuade ports to expand and get deeper and allow for deeper ships, and if you could persuade the trucking industry to change all their trucks so they could take these containers on board, and he did manage to do all these things, then he could streamline the process of loading and unloading a ship. So before... there's another good book called The Box about specifically about the rise in the economics of containerization, which is very fascinating. But according to The Box, then in the 1950s, a ship would have taken thousands and thousands and thousands of items on board, and it would have taken at least a week to unload or load. And it's just not like that anymore. There was a ship which was nicknamed SS Santa. A Maersk ship that was calling in at Felixstowe in England a few years ago, and it was a really big ship, and there was a lot of interest in it, and people came to see it, and the port was receiving telephone calls a week later saying, is the ship still here? And like every container ship, like the ship I was on, it had come and gone in 24 hours. They're never in port for longer than 24 hours unless there's a problem.
So a lot more flexibility. We received an email from Dave, and Dave asks both of you if you've read the book Supership by Lowell Mostert on his voyage of an early supertanker. Are you familiar with that book? Either?
I have not.
I haven't either.
Oh,
no, sorry.
Okay.
I have been advised to read it, but I haven't read it.
Ah, no. Okay. Yeah, because he was wondering about what's similar and what's different in the experiences. But we probably won't be able to answer that question since I haven't read the book either.
Well, I think, one of the things, if you talk to any working seafarers today, and particularly if they're of a certain age and they're looking back at their career, they'll routinely say it was more fun in the 1960s and 70s, because they had more time ashore and they had more... I mean, you just said, Jeff, that it was more flexible now, but I don't think it is. I think it probably is for the shipper and the people doing the business side of it, but for the seafarer, I think life has got a lot tougher in many ways. And they have very little time ashore, and So they will hark back to the golden days when they could, you know, go to all these exotic places and actually have time to go and visit them rather than sort of dash ashore and buy a newspaper and have to be back on board by 6 p.m.
Yeah, you talk a lot in your book about what life is like for folks who spend most of their life on these ships. It's difficult. It's rough.
It can be difficult. I mean, on the one hand, it's often a pretty well-paid job. It's a good job if you come from somewhere like Manila, where a government salary is not great, and you're probably going to earn more as a seafarer, particularly if you work for a good company. But as the Filipino seafarers said to me, you know, it's dollar for homesickness. And they, one of their other favourite phrases, which you'll hear from lots of seafarers, is it's prison with a salary. Because the conditions on board many ships, even good ships, are quite surprising. You know, only 20% of crew have freely available internet. So we're asking people to go to sea for often months at a time without something that most five-year-olds take for granted these days, which is, you know, Skyping and browsing and gaming. And they don't have that. And if the downside of that is that they don't really have time to get that when you come ashore either. So if you've ever taken a cruise and you come ashore at a port, I guarantee you will see a line of crew from your ship sitting on the ground or on tables just using the free Wi-Fi that's in the dockside store.
Hmm. John, I want to turn to you. And the Panama Canal, there's been a lot of activity there. They're expanding the canal, allow much bigger ships from Asia to reach the east coast of the U.S. much easier. And it's supposed to be completed this year, but they've run into some trouble and delays. What's happening with that expansion?
Well, they've run into repeated trouble and delays and cost overruns and political trouble. And, you know, one of the things to bear in mind is that even when it's done, U.S. ports are getting ready, but there's a very long way to go. In the U.S., only three East Coast ports, I think Baltimore, New York, and Norfolk, have shipping channels and container berths big enough to accommodate them. And Miami and Charleston are getting there, but they're still a very long way away. I think Savannah's en route to, they say they're a week or so away, but I think that's about the same position they were in when I was covering them 5 years ago. Now, not every port is going to be dredged, but given the sort of shipping industry's trend towards size, those that don't get dredged are going to have to sort of make some hard choices about how to remain a working port, whether to remain a fully working port. And so even once this canal is done, and it should be done, I think the deadline now is 2015 or 16, it's unclear sort of how many of those ships the U.S. will see.
And it's unclear because the why?
It's unclear because the ports just can't accommodate them. There are only three ports that can accommodate them.
And what are those? Do you know those three ports off the top of your head? I'm asking you to.
I think Baltimore, New York, and Norfolk.
Baltimore, New York, and Norfolk. Yeah. If you haven't done what must take the work must take years to finish, you're out of luck. We're talking about shipping with my guests. That's John Fassman of The Economist. We also have author Rose George. If you want to ask a question, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any question that you might have for our guests, we're looking forward to hearing from you. We'll be back after a break.
The Philadelphia Inquirer supports WHYY and offers the Live Life Love section, a new arts and entertainment section in the Sunday Inquirer, which includes upcoming concerts and events, fashion, coupons, restaurant reviews, and more. Details at inquirer.com/have you seen it.
The Mequon School, located on a wooded campus near Northwest Philadelphia, Mequon is a progressive elementary school for children ages 3 to 12. At the Mequon School, children's curiosity and initiative are an integral part of their education. Purposeful instruction is combined with opportunities for children to explore, discover, dream, and create. An information evening is October 8th at 6:30. Info at mequon.org/evening. Thank you.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the global shipping business with John Fassman and Rose George. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. And Rose, I want to get a little more idea of what it's like on the ships. It's very loud, right?
It vibrates.
So it's not really loud. It's more the vibrations?
It's loud in the engine room, which is why I generally avoided going in there. But a lot of ships now, sort of built over the last 10-20 years, are made in Korea, and I'm sure they're very nice ships. But certain seafarers think that they vibrate more than the other kind of older ships. So they definitely do vibrate. I mean, the first night in my quarters, which were very nice quarters on board, very nice cabin and a day room, and but there were bits of paper stuffed in all over the place, like under the TV, behind picture frames, and in the door hinges. And I didn't know what they were. I thought they were maybe trying to stop smuggling or something, because I had to sign some declaration that I wouldn't smuggle anything. And then the first night, I suddenly realized what it was, because everything was vibrating in the room, and I ended up running around the cabin at about 2 o'clock in the morning, stuffing more bits of paper behind more in under door frames and everywhere just to get some sleep. So, noisy in that way, but otherwise pretty calm, pretty quiet, pretty empty. I mean, there's only 18, 19 of us on this huge ship, and you, in the evenings, you tended not to see anybody, because on a modern ship, most people just go back to their cabins and watch DVDs on their individual laptops. So there's not much socializing at all.
So just like standing there, can you feel the vibrations?
Yeah, you can. It's worse on, I think it was on the port side I was on, and it's worse on certain decks.
Mm.
So I just happened to be, the second engineer said that he sometimes had to physically hold his computer mouse down because it was jumping around so much.
Wow. So what did that feel like when you got on solid land after that amount of time of vibrating?
Quiet.
All right. We're going to go to the telephone. We have Frank from Kimberton. Frank, welcome to Radio Times. You're on.
Thank you for having such a wonderful program. Specifically this, and also in general, the transition from the longshoreman system to the container system meant that a lot of people lost their jobs. And I know the Longshoremen's Union was very powerful, even, you know, supposedly underworld connections. I was wondering how that transition actually even happened, and also, you know, what had happened.
I'm not sure who's best to answer that. Is that something you can answer, John?
It's a great question. I'm not sure. I mean, I know that most of the ports are still unionized, right? But I think one thing that one reason for the huge job losses is containerization didn't require individuals to sort of unload unwieldy packages, or even to do, you know, much physical unloading at all. They're crane controlled, and you have inspectors, but you just don't have the same labor requirements that you had before containerization.
I guess it's another example of how using more of these containers really changed the business, Rose.
Yeah, and it was a pretty long and bloody process, actually. Again, I'd refer anyone to read the box, because that gives a really exhaustive account of how the longshoremen and the dockers were brought into line. I mean, really, they lost the battle, really, against containerizations, because they didn't want it, because they knew that it would be huge job losses. And I guess it just made such economic sense for the industry that Malcolm McLean's arguments eventually won the day. And John's right. You don't need many longshoremen anymore. There are still some, but you just don't need as much labor.
John, I want to go back to you. And I think that if you ask most Americans, like, to come up with one question about the shipping industry, that it might be about the flags that ships fly under. Why do a lot of ships, even if they have pretty strong U.S. connections or connections to another country, why do they have flags under a third country?
Well, because it's very convenient to register them in some countries, and it's much less convenient in others. And it's these flags, the flags that ships fly are generally known as flags of convenience, and they're registered in countries with easy incorporation laws rather than the country where they come from.
And Rose, you have some interesting history about this, because it didn't start with these container ships. It started with cruise ships, didn't it?
No, I think it started in Prohibition. I think
yes, with cruise with the cruise ships in during Prohibition.
Oh, I assumed it was cargo. Maybe, yeah, you may be right. There's a couple of origin myths about flags of convenience, but okay. And in fact, I mean, switching flags was pretty common in shipping it right back into the 15th and 16th centuries. If you were a ship flying a certain flag and you happened to be in the wrong waters in the wrong war, then ships would switch flags. But as an industry and as a business, which open registries, as the industry likes to call them, they don't like flags of convenience. So I do call them flags of convenience. But and some, you know, to be fair, some of these flags of convenience are very good. Liberia is pretty good. Marshall Islands has definitely cleaned up its act. But some of them are not. And some of them, the trouble with flags of convenience or open registries, whatever we want to call them, the trouble with allowing ships to fly flags from any country they choose is that once they do that, then the laws governing that ship, once it's out on the high seas, are whichever country that is. So people who go on cruises and they check that they've got a safe in their room and their valuables are safe, what I would do on the cruise ship, the first thing I would check is what flag it's flying. Because once you're out at sea, that's whose police force is going to be controlling you. And it's very, very easy if you want to do something bad at sea. You could quite easily get away with things under certain flags of convenience because they don't have the authority or law enforcement that they should have. And it's worrying. And a lot of them offer anonymity as an attraction to the business owner. So if something does go wrong, then it can be far easier than it should be to slip away. And in fact, The Economist, which I think it's fair to say likes free markets, even though this is the freest market on the planet, really, flags of convenience and shipping, did once call them cat's cradles of ownership structures. So if they're calling them, if The Economist thinks they're complicated, then they're complicated.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk a little bit about environmental concerns and the global shipping industry. John Fastman, I was actually reading an Economist article that mentioned efforts to sort of clean up some of this sulfur-laden oil that ships are burning now. Are you familiar with those rules from the International Maritime Organization?
Yeah, they can't. These are particularly in North America and Europe. Ships, they have traditionally burned the sort of nastiest, sulfurous, unrefined fuel they could find. And the byproduct of that fuel tends to be ammonia, and they cause some really nasty stuff for people who live on the coast. So they've had to clean up the sort of fuel that they've been using, and they're now using, I believe, they're using diesel just like trucks or airplanes are.
Hmm. And, Rose, you talk about in your book that just one of these ships, even though they can transport pretty efficiently, right? I mean, when you compare it to other forms of transportation, but just one of these ships can put out a huge amount of pollution, like equivalent to a coal-fired power plant?
Yeah, I mean, shipping is the greenest industry in terms of how much it transports and what it costs us environmentally. It's much, much greener than aviation or trucks by far. But the trouble is that there's so much shipping that it's not benign. It's got a footprint, and it's got a pretty big footprint. In terms of global emissions, it's pretty much on a par with aviation in terms of the stuff that the bunker fuel, which John was referring to, the emissions that produces. I mean, if you put it on a list of emissions producing countries, it comes in number six. So it's not benign by any means. Now, the shipping industry is cleaning up certainly more than it has done in the past. And there are these now low sulfur zones where they have to use low sulfur fuel, which is good for people who live on the coast. It's also good for the environment. But the trouble is that bunker fuel, which is the stuff they use, which has been described to me as the dregs of the refinery, is so cheap. And when it costs quite a lot of money to run a ship, it can be $100,000 a day sometimes, then where costs can be cut, then they are cut.
I think a lot of us have probably heard about the concerns over ballast water and sort of transporting water from one part of the country to another part of the country, and then you can bring some invasive species along with that water and introduce things that you don't want introduced into new waterways. But a listener sent in an email asking a question that kind of stems off of that I thought was kind of interesting. And she was wondering, this was from Cindy, and she said, is there any research being done on the high incidence of insect borers coming into the country and wiping out our native trees? And she says that these insect borers come in on wooden pallets via the container ships. Have either of you heard of this?
Nope. I know about ballast water, but I don't know about insect borers. No.
Have you heard of concern about pallets, John?
No, news to me.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about ballast water then.
I've taken notes, though.
Yeah, it's a very interesting issue because I just hadn't really heard much about the pallets, but it kind of makes sense. But this idea of transporting water from, just kind of run through that for me, if you will, Rose.
Well, when a ship needs to be balanced, obviously, to be stable at sea. So if they're empty, which they often are going from Europe and the US towards Asia, because we get everything from Asia, we don't manufacture very much anymore. So they're often balanced, stabilized by using ballast water, which is often just seawater sucked into the ballast tanks on the ship. But obviously, then you're taking water from one part of the world and you're discharging it in another, and you can also take other stuff with it. And there's some famous examples of invasive species, the zebra mussel, which has caused great damage in the US. The mitten crab is another one. And there is now, the Ballast Water Convention is which is an IMO regulation, the International Maritime Organization, has been on the books for years, but is about to come into force. It's thought that enough countries will sign to bring it into force. But if you talk to anybody in the industry, they're all very, very worried that there isn't actually the technology ready to go along with what those regulations require. So you need things that clean the ballast water and filter it safely so that invasive species aren't carried along. And they're very worried that it's kind of cart before the horse, and there'll be this law and regulation, and there won't be the technology to go with it.
And anything new adds to the cost of doing business. And when you're in these boom and bust cycles that we talked about at the beginning of the program, that I suppose that makes that more difficult. And John, I want to turn to you. We talked about how much pollution one of these ships can put out. But then we also talked about how efficient they are for moving goods. And here in the U.S., we see television ads by railroads saying how much they can transfer this amount of freight a mile. And it's kind of an impressive number. I wonder, do you think shipping companies haven't done a lot to sort of explain how efficient they can transport stuff?
I think that's generally true, not just in terms of efficiency, but one of the things that Rose's book points out so well is that it's largely an invisible industry, because these ships are either off high seas where there's no one around, or they're on sort of canals and industrial waterways where there are very few people around. And so I think the shipping industry could do more to sort of market itself best for its efficiency. But it's just not an industry that is terribly visible to many people, and that's the nature of urban architecture.
Yeah, and since it's not visible, when it changes, I guess we don't hear a lot about it. And I'm wondering, so much of our world changes with new technologies. Are there new technologies in the shipping industry that are changing that industry? I've heard something about hybrid engines. Do either of you know about those?
Yeah, Maersk is very excited about this, I don't know if it's a hybrid engine, heat retention system that uses the heat, the steam captured from the burns to further power the engine.
And Rose, is this an industry that is interested in adopting new technology, or are they kind of slow to do that?
Certain companies are quicker to embrace new things than others. It has been traditionally quite an inward-looking industry. It's been a very family business industry, not publicly owned in many cases, and it hasn't really had much spotlight on it since the Second World War and the Battle of the Atlantic, when the merchant navy was so fundamental. But excuse me. But it needs to have more attention. It needs to be more visible. It needs to be more public because it needs crew and it needs officers. And it is a real problem that they're facing an officer shortage. So it needs to get young people to want to go to sea. But in the US and particularly the UK, Northern Europe, young people don't want to go to sea anymore. They don't want to be deprived of their iPads and their, you know, their constant internet access and their friends who are down the pub every day. And it's difficult to sell, but it can be a really, really rewarding career for a few years. But most many seafarers are not at sea for more than 10 years. They see it as a stepping stone to getting a shoreside job. So you don't get these decades of experience anymore, really.
We just have about a half a minute here, but maybe just tell me what's sort of been the reception of your book in the shipping industry.
Well, I expected there to be quite a lot of criticism because I am critical of some aspects of the shipping industry, even though I had a really great time on board and I really salute seafarers. I think they're doing an amazing job. But in fact, the industry has really embraced it and been really supportive. And obviously, it's a mature enough industry that it can take some criticism. And it's been really quite amazing and gratifying that they seem to find it useful as a way of explaining to people what they do.
Very good.
And to tell their families what their jobs involve.
Very good. Rose George is author of the book 90% of Everything. We also have John Fassman, Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for The Economist. Thanks much for being here today.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. The engineer today is Kevin Griffin. The producers of Radio Times are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain.